Congress was going to make a law banning the VCR,
yep.
you know, reason recoils from the idea that you shouldn't be able to record a television show and watch it later.
Right.
Right? And it's really easy to explain to constituents that, you know, Congressman Chubby Bottom in office there just destroyed, you know, the device in your living room.
So that's easy to understand. But it's also, you know, the counter arguments are also interesting about you know, piracy. And this is an interesting book I've been looking at now about that. Familiar with this?
No.
It's really good. And it's just about how, you know, some of the side effects of globalization and the amount of the political influence of mafias and quasi-legal entities in the face of, you know, the new digital realities.
And it's interesting.
So I think it's an interesting situation, it's an interesting problem, and, you know, is it possible to foresee a time when, you know, you can't make a money on a movie other than by doing product placement, because there's no way to charge for a disc. Nobody will pay for it. They can get it for free.
Well, let me park that for a second. Push that on the stack. We'll pop it in a second. But in terms of the illicit economy, I think that the thing that is remarkable about the illicit economy is that it's gone global.
Right.
The thing that's not remarkable about it is that it's trading in illicit goods. I think regardless of what goods are and aren't illicit,
right.
that the underground economy would embark on them. We could ban pink shirts,
right.
and that's what the mafia would sell.
Right.
Right? The remarkable thing is that the communications technology that advantages the defenders, right, law enforcement, also advantages the attackers,
right.
mafiosi. Right.
Right,
so you can establish a global mafia enterprise in a way that you never could before. But the fact that they chose movies or they chose DVDs or whatever, and in fact DVDs are a really interesting example of a good that is probably not long for the illicit world, because you know what the mafia likes is high margin goods, right?
Right.
It's really hard to make your own cocaine.
Right.
Right. And as a consequence, the mafia can command a natural monopoly, right? Without having, you know, the mafia isn't shy about shooting people who compete with them, but it's hard to shoot your customers when they compete with you. If you could grow cocaine in your living room as a kind of low risk activity, it's right. unlikely that you could sell a lot of coke, right?
Right.
Now, the number of people who can't pirate a DVD in their living room is going down and down and down, right?
Right.
And you know, sure, there are some people who buy illicit DVDs without knowing it, you know, thinking that it's illicit. But, you know, I think the majority of that trade are people who understand completely that they're buying bootleg goods. And, you know, when the guy who's buying the DVD on Broadway from a guy with a blanket can make that same DVD at home for less than a dollar in less than an hour,
right.
it limits how much the mafia can charge for it, right?
Right, right. So the goods they talk about here are weapons, drugs,
well,
people.
It says,
you know,
movies too.
Well,
right?
Movies too, but that's one of five areas.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. I think the mafia is scary. Don't get me wrong. You know, my family lives in the former Soviet Union. I'm really sharply, keenly aware of how screwed up your life can be if you live in a failed state run by kleptocrat mafiosi.
Right.
Right. But you know, I don't think that the particulars of the goods they trade are the key thing to note here. The
right.
key thing to note is that their undertakings have gone global, right?
Right.
So push that on, you know, so pop the stack that you were asking about the counter arguments about piracy and will people or won't people be able to make movies and so on. And I think that there's a kind of narrow definition of what a movie is that arises from a kind of, an overwhelming presence of one kind of filmmaking in our lives, right?
Right.
In the same way that it was easy to believe before the Protestant Reformation that if you took apart the church and allowed lots of different small-c churches to form, that you wouldn't ever get cathedral building anymore, and so you wouldn't ever get religion, right? Well, it's true that after the Reformation, it was very hard to raise the capital to spend four generations building a cathedral. But that didn't mean that religion ended, quite the contrary, right? The explosion in a marketplace for faith
right.
actually led to more,
right.
right? And so we actually do see the beginnings of filmmakers making films that are suited to the economics of the internet, that are artistically at least as satisfying as anything that, say, the Lumiere brothers were making at the dawn of this era of film,
right.
the one that's just coming to a close, who are making perfectly good livings. I know someone who was involved in an attempted buyout of the Red versus Blue guys, who make a machinima comedy short, weekly comedy short,
right.
who says that those guys are making $500,000 a year each.
Wow.
Right?
That's not bad. Well, I'm just saying, you know, I first of all, I think that that, you know, I'm a paid up member of EFF, so I understand where things are going. So, and I understand you can't stop the tide, you know. But also, I two movies I watched recently and liked a lot were Capote and Syriana.
I haven't seen either of them.
Yeah, well, Syriana in particular throws a lot of money to make.
Right.
Right? And it's an important movie about globalization and oil addiction and, you know, all that stuff,
but
right?
But cathedrals are beautiful and uplifting.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
you know, the question needs to be, as much merit as a cathedral or a $200 million movie has, is it so much merit that we should foreclose on all new practices of film that might displace it?
Right.
In order to preserve its longevity, right? And, you know, as beautiful as a cathedral is, as wonderful as the vaudeville circuit was, right. As amazing as the explosion of broadcast television across the country was, as wonderful as the cable industry's, you know,
or
penetration into our living rooms.
And operas,
yeah,
maybe,
I mean,
you know, not long for the world.
Right. I mean, do we foreclose? Do you know? Was it? Is it? Is it? A good outcome to foreclose on,
right,
on you know, the possibility of the future in order to safeguard the past?
Well, that's
or
an
do we
question.
You know, should we well, and this leads into your question about publishing. So I think that there's a couple of things to note about publishing, a kind of a baseline we can work from. The first is that it's not that information wants to be free. I think that that's not kind of, that's an ideological statement about information.
Yeah.
I think the realpolitik of bits is that they are getting steadily easier to copy, and barring something like a nuclear holocaust, they will continue to get easier to copy.
Right.
So to the extent that you have a business or practice that relies on the idea that bits will get harder to copy than
they are
today,
right.
You're doomed, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
that's just for starters. And then the other thing is that there's no future in telling the people who are the potential customers for your products or services that they're crooks and that what they want is bad. Even if you believe it, maybe even especially if you believe it, telling the people who you're trying to get to voluntarily part with money that you think that they're crooks and dishonest will discourage them from parting with money. It may not eliminate their ability to part, you know, your ability to compel some money from them, but it never helps, right? There's no world in which that helps. So all other things follow from that, I think. Right now, electronic goods are a salutary adjunct to a print good, right? I think that, you know, the classic story for me of how people consume my books is they buy the print book, they download the electronic book, the print book lives on their bedstand, they read a few pages before bed, the electronic book lives on their phone, they read a few pages on the subway, and then occasionally they'll print out a chapter and take it to the beach,
right?
That's the, and what the electronic book is for them is a mechanism, in addition to that, is a mechanism for evangelizing the text to other people, where they can loan it to friends without depriving themselves of their copy of it, and B, without ever having to be physically proximate with their friends. So if you're a slash dork whose 20 million best friends live
the ether,
all you know about them is where their IP addresses are, then you know, this is a mechanism that you can use to loan books to friends, and you know, that's one thing we know is that the single biggest determinant of whether or not someone's going to buy a book is whether or not it's been recommended by friends. And then, you know, the second retail element about book buying is that at least half, if not more, of the book buyers surveyed don't set out to buy books. They set out to do something else, like check into a hotel or buy some groceries or pick up a prescription, and they see a book and then they buy it. The collapse of the serendipitous market for books in the form of spinner racks and drugstores and grocery stores has been a disaster for publishing. Now, you know, the big box stores are great in that they stock more SKUs than ever before.
But you got to go in there.
But you've got to be there only, they're only useful for the converted, right?
Right,
I mean,
right, yeah.
it's like saying, well, we've got this, you know, dynamic new preacher at the pulpit, but he's only heard by people who show up in the church.
Right.
Right? You know, and so you can't convert more people to your faith if the preacher never leaves the pulpit, right? So, you know, where we have things like Google Book Search that put a book on the end of a search query as opposed to just a web page, we start to reintroduce serendipity to the process of book buying.
Right.
When all the unionized truck drivers who delivered books to drugstores and grocery stores were all laid off, and when distributorship consolidated, you know, the old truck drivers, they had this great incentive structure, which was they got a bonus if they delivered books that sold, And right. they had to do more work if the books didn't sell because they had to take them back again. They weren't necessarily big readers, but if you drove a route for 50 years, you get to figure out what would maximize your incentives. Right. Non-union truck drivers who have short horizons on their work and who are moved from route to route and who are contractors and at-will employees and all the rest of it, they never do this. And as a consequence, book sales have fallen by about 50%.
Do you have a citation on it? It's a fascinating
thing. Tom Doherty from Tor Books is the right guy to ask. He's the publisher of Tor Books. He started as a sales guy, and he runs Tor now.
Oh, cool.
Largest science fiction book publisher in the world, division of Holzbrink. So he's a great guy to ask about this.
That's a fascinating story.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
So Google Book Search is the next best thing, right? As is Amazon Book Search and so on. So that said, is there a potential that down the road, an electronic book will substitute for a print book at least some of the time? I think it's already happening that some of the time it does. People who make tabletop RPGs, for example, I think find that the electronic edition is, for many of their potential customers, superior to the print edition. Because obviously, rule books that are only used in with discretionary time and leisure contexts that are that move from place to place, if you have to lug 100 pounds of them around and have to figure out what page the thing that you're trying to cite is on,
then that's
less valuable, right?
Right.
Now, that said, of course, there has never been a time since the beginning of time that was better to be a game designer than right now, right? I mean, it's not tabletop RPGs anymore. It's another, Protestant Reformation cathedrals versus Kirk's story, right? I mean, when was a better time to be a game designer than now, when tens of thousands of game designers are gainfully employed in a giant, well-capitalized industry, as opposed to a couple hundred freelancers and maybe 25 employees at TSR, right? I mean, this is a great era to be a game designer. But it may be that happens to the rest of us, right?
Well, what I'm curious about, I mean, so I published both of these myself.
Right.
And this one I tried really hard to get picked up by a real publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this one I just said, fuck it. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any interest in trying to shop around. And first of all, because that was so debilitating, exhausting to do it.
It takes a long time.
And second of all, this is a much more challenging book than that.
Right.
So if I couldn't sell the easier to access one, how am I going to sell the one that, is for, But so I'm curious, but I can't get a distributor. That's the thing is I sell lots of books through Amazon and through my website, and I've got three or four bookstores that really like my books, so they're always calling me up saying, John, send me another case.
Right.
But that's it. You can't walk into a bookstore and find my books. You got to find me on the internet and send me a PayPal or a check in the mail.
Yeah, the distributorship, the narrowing of the distributor channels has been a real problem for a lot of different markets. I just blogged this morning about a magazine. It was like a third year marketing school project for a student who's since got a business built on it. And the magazine fits behind a peel back label on soda pop bottles, right? And the reason they're doing this isn't because that form factor is particularly useful or because
it'll get in the store.
It's because there's a much more sophisticated and robust distributorship system for soda pop than there is for magazines, right? So they can piggyback on a bigger and better industry. So the question is, if electronic text begins to substitute for the kind of print that the print text that you want to write or that I want to write, how do we respond? Well, I think that it's not clear how we respond. What do you do to make money off of electronic books in an era where electronic books are substitute for print books and where you can't stop copying? And I think there are a couple of things that might give you one of those outcomes. There's a generation of people who are more comfortable with reading off of screens, albeit they don't read traditional narrative, right? But they do read for 18 hours a day off a screen. I think that that's actually not bad news for reading, but probably bad news for traditional narrative, right? Just like people in an era of pop music listen to more music than ever did before, they just don't listen to a lot of symphonies. So if you're making symphonies, you're kind of in trouble, right? There's only so many Philip Glasses and so on. So text might give way, or screens might get a little better, or people might get more willing to read off of screens, and likely some combination of those three will take some of the audience for books and say to them, and then the final piece, of course, is that you can make a codex, you can make a book shaped like this one out of an electronic text with increasing ease and closer and closer to the reader, right? And already readers are doing this in their own homes for disposable ones. You know, a robust codex is hard. But, you know, my publisher, when they want to run extra galleys of a book to send out to a reviewer, if they run into those incredibly expensive bound galleys, they run them two columns with a narrow gutter and narrow gutters around the page, a mirrored wide gutter on the left side, double-sided. You can get a 120,000 word book onto 40 paper pages. You can put three staples down the side. It's good for about two reads. You can read it on the bus. Unlike a bound manuscript, you can read it on the bus.
Yep.
And your editorial assistant can produce one in 10 minutes.
Right.
Right? So, you know, from a reader's perspective, if you need a codex, not hard to generate at home, getting easier every day, right? So some combination of these things might make it increasingly harder to sell a bound clay-coated, glossy cover, printed spine, four-color, full bleed, perfect bound book. That said...
Well, what I'm doing, my next book is illustrated. So,
right.
So I'm putting in pictures that you might want to actually hold in your hand
and
look at, right?
And, you know, I think that there will always be a market for that in the same way that there will always be a market for a symphony, right?
Right.
I mean, but the market for symphonies is... I don't know what the answer to this is, but I would bet even money that there's more money spent on symphonies in real adjusted dollars today than at the heyday of symphonies.
Well, probably. I mean, also, I mean, where do we hear symphonic music more? We hear it in movies these days.
Right. So. Well, and in Muzak, right? 100 strings orchestras.
And, you know.
Although MIDI is making that go away, you know. But that said. Symphonic music is a smaller piece of the practice of music. It's a smaller piece of a much larger pie, even though in absolute terms it might be bigger.
Right. You know? My father was president of the Hartford Symphony, Hartford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the most thankless jobs he's ever had. He was a volunteer fireman for 25 years, and he'd been volunteer and charity oriented. He's mm-hmm. being president of the symphony, because what he had to do was put the squeeze on the rich people to give more money
right.
and tell the unions that it wasn't enough money.
Right.
To play. And for this, he got on the front page of the Hartford, you know, newspapers for being the asshole. Right,
right,
you know,
sure.
You know, and you know, I just like to go to the symphony, and I'm good at running organizations, so I volunteered to do this.
Right.
When he said, we can't pay you, and we can't meet your demands, he wasn't kidding.
Right.
You know, there just was no more money. But the problem there wasn't just, you know, declining popularity of symphonies, it was declining popularity of Hartford, Connecticut.
I mean,
the city was going down. That was
right.
the problem.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it's often a complex story like that, where there are multifactorial things that lead to some outcome. But I think that the answer I'm trying to get at here is that the way that we figure out how we make electronic text is by observing what happens when people use electronic text and seeing if there's anything in there that we can charge money for.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, the way that we don't figure out is by running Gedanken experiments in our head and coming up with a priori conclusions about how people will use electronic text and what they're willing to pay for, and then using technology to lock them into those uses, right? And saying, you know, here's a DRM wrapper in which everything that's not mandatory is prohibited,
right?
Now let's see how that experiment turns out, right? I mean, you know, it's the chances are that you're going to fail, because the only thing that your audience can't teach you anything. The only way that this will work is if, you know, in your head, your Gedanken experiment teaches you the one true
What's
thing.
What's that word, Gedanken?
Gedanken experiment, you know, a thought experiment, like classic,
I didn't know the word Gedanken.
Gedanken, like a lot of physics is built around Gedanken experiments, where you say, imagine this, imagine that. That's how you decide what actual piece of apparatus you're going to build, right? But you know, this is this kind of Gedanken experiment, it's a kind of arrogance, right? It's like, I am smarter than the crowd,
right?
I know more about how my readers want to read this than my readers do. I will deafen myself to demand signals and be a supply side that instructs the demand how it should be structured, right? It's economically, it's a less robust approach than actually listening to demand signals and supplying them, right? You know, like DRM, there's no customer who woke up this morning saying, I wish there was a way I could do less with my music.
Right?
There's no demand signal for it.
Right?
What there is a demand signal for is like MP3s, right? Fastest adopted technology in the history of the world is peer-to-peer file sharing, right? Commercialize that, right? Like stop standing on the beach telling everyone that the waves are too high and it hasn't been half an hour since you had lunch, and instead start selling bathing suits in copper tone.
Right?
I mean, it's the most thankless job in the world to be the kind of Pecksniff who tells people that the thing that they love doing is immoral.
Right.
You know, it's just like, it's, you know, And you know, as someone who's campaigned for a nonprofit, I understand that there's a time and a place to do it. But it's a bad way to run a commercial enterprise. I mean, it's a bad way to run a commercial enterprise.
Right.